The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Chronic obstructive lung disease is presented by Dr. Amita Vasoya.
My topic today is chronic obstructive lung disease. It's a huge topic. It encompasses a lot of No disclosures. I don't have money either. Chronic obstructive lung disease includes a broad topic. I can't talk about everything in 30 minutes, but the two major topics that I will focus on that it will be tested is COPD and asthma. The other topics listed there, bronchiectasis, bronchiolitis, cystic fibrosis, and alpha-1 antitrypsin, you should be aware or familiar with just a little bit. When we look at lung disease, with obstructive lung disease, there is an interrelationship of all the obstructive lung diseases. And the two main commonalities is inflammation and bronchial hyperreactivity. With COPD, there's less reversibility versus asthma. Asthma, you will see more reversibility. COPD is the third leading cause of death worldwide. It is the only leading cause of death whose prevalence is really increasing, and some of that may be due to our awareness and early diagnosis in these patients. And this is just another graph showing that COPD ranks number three, just under ischemic heart disease and stroke. We often think of COPD as the most inciting factor being cigarette smoking, but you also should remember other factors that can cause obstructive lung disease, and that's, one of the biggest is occupational exposures, silica, formaldehyde, toluene, the rest are listed there. Air pollution is another one, biomass fuel exposure, asthma, genetic factors, they all can lead to obstructive disease. When we look at the pathogenesis, you take a look at the inciting factor, in this case we'll say cigarette smoking, and what happens is there is the trigger, the agent, that activates alveolar macrophages, and then you have release of monocytes, neutrophils, and in COPD it's the CD8 lymphocyte, and that releases proteases, and which ultimately leads to mucus hypersecretion and alveolar wall destruction. Again, just the inflammatory mediators, I mentioned the neutrophils, the macrophages, and the CD8 lymphocytes. They all cause the damages that are listed there and ultimately lead to airway disease and parenchymal destruction, which then lead to airflow limitation. Exacerbations represent a further amplification of the inflammatory process. And again, there is a trigger, whether it be cigarette smoking, there's another trigger, usually bacterial or some kind of infection, bacteria, viruses, or pollutants that can cause the exacerbation. As far as the definition of chronic bronchitis, we all know, or you're probably familiar with, it's defined as the excessive tracheobronchial mucus production associated with cough, sputum expectoration for at least 3 months out of the year for more than two consecutive years. There may or may not be reversibility in this disease. Again, like I said, asthma, there's usually more reversibility than with COPD. Again, with COPD, you have involvement of the large airways as well as the small airways. You will have, again, hyperplasia, hypertrophy, mucus secretion, and inflammation. And you can see that what this results in is airway narrowing. You have the normal bronchi on the left side, and then the person with the chronic bronchitis on the right, with copious mucus secretion, airway narrowing, muscle hypertrophy. With the emphysematous patient, the pathology is a little bit different. There's stretching, if you will. There's enlarged alveoli, fewer capillaries, but again, there is inflammation and hyperreactivity. Skip through that. I'm going to focus the American Thoracic Society, the European Respiratory Society, and then you have the GOLD criteria. So I believe what you'll probably be tested on is the GOLD criteria, and that's really what I focused on here today. The newer guidelines were just released in October 2016, and I don't think that'll be tested, but this is from the latest board review that I've taken, so you will hopefully have a concise a review. The GOLD guidelines, they define COPD as a preventable and treatable disease with some significant extrapulmonary effects that may contribute to severity in individual patients. The airflow limitation is not fully reversible, and it is usually persistent and progressive. It's associated with, again, with inflammation, exposure to noxious substances or gases. A clinical diagnosis of COPD, it should be considered in any patient who has dyspnea, chronic cough, sputum production, and a history of any of the exposures that we mentioned. Spirometry is necessary for the diagnosis. What you're looking for on spirometry is a post-bronchodilator FEV1 FVC ratio less than 70. That's across the board for all the stages. And then you look at the FEV1 at the different gradations, which the next few slides will illustrate. You want at least less than 80%. And in the individual that has the cough, sputum production, the dyspnea, and the exposure to the risk factors. The GOLD guidelines divide COPD into the different stages, and then they go on to categorize the patients into category A, B, C, D when you want to look at what treatment options they fit in. For stage one, mild COPD, the FEV1 FVC ratio is less than 70% across the board. You look at the FEV1, it's about 80% or less than just under 80%. Stage two is 50 to 80%. Three is 30 to 40, or 30 to 50, sorry. And four is less than 30. When we look at reversibility, when we find that they have obstruction on spirometry, we usually give them a bronchodilator and then we do the spirometry again. And what you're looking for with the reversibility is an increase in their FEV1 of 200 cc's or 12% improvement in their FEV1 post-treatment with either the bronchodilator or inhaled corticosteroid. We also use two assessment tools, or one or both you can use, and this is listed in the GOLD criteria as well. The first one listed there is the CAT testing, which is a COPD assessment test. It's a numeric scale. It evaluates 8 functional parameters. Some of them are cough, sputum, walking, sleeping, energy, etc. And the lower the score, the fewer the symptoms they usually have, and the higher the score, they have more symptoms usually. And then the other scale is the Modified Medical Research Council questionnaire, and it basically is another subjective scale. It evaluates the degree of breathlessness these patients feel doing certain activities, and the higher the value, it indicates decreased exercise tolerance. And I definitely can't see that, but I'm sure you can Google the different questions that are asked. Again, sleeping, walking, things of that sort, with minimal exertion, they ask those kinds of questions. And this one, again, it's the MMRC questionnaire, a 0 to 4 scale, and the higher the score, the more symptoms you have with minimal activity. So the GOLD criteria, they go on to categorize the patient into different categories, category A, B, C, and D. They not only take the spirometry in consideration, but they also take a look at how many exacerbations they have per year, and they look at their CAT score or their MMRC score. And for category A, For category A, they are low-risk patients. They have fewer symptoms, less exacerbations. Their CAT score and their MMRC score is low. So for category A and B, as far as the spirometry is concerned, it's usually less than 50%, more than 50%. And then your C and D category is the FEV1 less than 50%. And then for GOLD 3 and 4, it's C and D category. GOLD 1 and 2, it's A and B category. So again, as you go down through the categories, the more symptoms they have, the more severe their spirometry results, and their symptom score is higher. A lot of times, as I mentioned, the patients don't come to us early enough. They may come to us at a later stage, or that we as physicians are not attuned to the different testing that's out there, or looking for patients or treating them early enough. Obviously, you want to start with a history and physical examination. You want to assess their symptoms, cough, sputum production, dyspnea, their risk factors. Are they smoking, which is probably the biggest risk factor? Spirometry, again, is essential. You want to do imaging on these patients, chest x-ray to start with, and you may want to do a CAT scan, yearly low-dose CAT scan for your smokers, which I will get into in my lung cancer lecture. Pulse oximetry is very important. You want to check their pulse oximetry at rest and also with exertion. At rest, they may be okay, but once they start to tax their heart and lungs when they start walking, you may find that their pulse oximetry drops. ABG can be done if you still have, if their pulse oximetry with exercise or at rest is borderline and you still want to see, you want to check their oxygenation, you can check a blood gas. And primarily, you want to look to see if they qualify for home oxygen, because that is one of the most important treatment guidelines when you get into your severe category. And also, please don't forget to screen your patients, especially your young patients, for alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. We all know this picture, the pink puffer and the blue bloater. Your emphysematous patient and your chronic bronchitis patient. This is just a little chart you can go through. It basically differentiates the predominant symptoms for the chronic bronchitis patient versus your emphysematous patient. With your chronic bronchitis patient, they usually have symptoms early on, whereas the emphysematous patient is later on in their life, in the 50 to 70 age range. Not hard and fast, this is just a chart. Your chronic bronchitis person has more sputum production, and respiratory limitation. Core pulmonale is common in your chronic bronchitis patient versus it's a late finding in your emphysematous patient. This slide Dr. Morley just went through, again, with your obstructed patient, the slope continues to, it doesn't even plateau, it goes up and up and up. They're continuing to try to exhale and get that air out. And their FEV1 is reduced compared to the normal patient. Again, Dr. Morley also went through this. This is, you see that little scooping, if you will, but this is more of an illustration of airway collapse where you have a complete, a significant drop in their FEV1 right when they start to exhale. Other systemic features, please keep in mind, these patients expend a lot of energy just to breathe, and they can have cachexia, loss of muscle mass, skeletal muscle wasting, osteoporosis, if they're on chronic steroids or whatnot, depression, because it is a chronic disease, and certainly it can cause an impact. A lot of times they may have some degree of anemia, but also keep in mind the cardiovascular risk factors. They are increased. They are at increased risk for heart issues and disease. Exercise limitation. Normal. If you do an exercise test on these patients, they will have some degree of exercise limitation. Normal individuals will never really stop exercising because of respiratory limitations. However, your COPD patient will have a reduced to maximum ventilation, and this can limit their exercise capacity. And they will desaturate usually with exercise. So the goals, before I go through the guidelines in terms of what the approach we use, remember the goals are to slow the disease progression, identify the risk factors, help them with smoking cessation, reduce the frequency of exacerbations, and ultimately improve their quality of life. So this is a slide I put in a few slides ago. It's the same one which goes through the patient categories that GOLD divides these patients into, category A and B, and then it's GOLD 1 and 2, and then C and D is 3 and 4 based on the spirometry. And then you have your CAT score and the MMR score. I won't reiterate the same thing. But what I want to focus on now is the treatment. And treatment is primarily guided by what category these patients fall into. If they fall into the category A, the one with few symptoms, with greater functional status, you want to start with short-acting beta agonist on a PRN basis, or a short-acting anticholinergic on a PRN basis. Some of the alternative choices are there, but I'm just going to go through the recommended first choices. For your category B, if they continue to have more symptoms, more breathlessness, you may want to switch from a PRN to a long-acting of the same agent, either a LABA or a LAMA. And for your more symptomatic patient, for category C, you want to add an inhaled glucocorticoid with your long-acting LABA or LAMA. And for your category D, you can do your inhaled corticosteroid, your LABA, and a LAMA, and then the alternatives are listed there. So I won't belabor the point. This you can find on the GOLD website as well. Oops. The side effects, I can't read them too well from here, but as far you're probably familiar with the side effects of your beta agonist, primarily tachycardia. Hypokalemia is also one of the side effects. Your short-acting anticholinergic agents, you have dry mouth, mydriasis, tachycardia, tremor is also in there. You be careful in patients that have acute narrow-angle glaucoma, things of that sort. Generally, the both are pretty well tolerated. For your long-acting, again, the side effects are the same. They can be more pronounced. For your methylxanthines, tachycardia, nausea, vomiting, those are some of the side effects. Your oral beta-2 agonists, I don't really use them, but again, you have the same sympathomimetic symptoms. Your oral phosphodiesterase inhibitors are also they also have side effects. Everything has side effects. Diarrhea and nausea are the most common side effects with those agents. And then your anti-inflammatory agents, you know, the inhaled glucocorticoids, you can get thrush, dysphonia. Those are the more common things. And then your oral glucocorticoids, we're all aware of, hyperglycemia, skin bruising, adrenal suppression. So keep those in mind when you have these patients because they are going to be on them for a long term. This slide I put up here, it reiterates the stepwise approach. But the point I want to make with these patients, please remember that all these patients must receive their vaccinations, your influenza and pneumonia vaccinations are a must. And also, if you see here in the second, you can see here, add rehabilitation. And you want to start it early on. You don't want to wait till they're in their third or fourth stage. You want to add pulmonary rehab right from the beginning if they can tolerate it. And then also, please keep in mind that you want to also evaluate these patients for oxygen early on. Additional treatment, aside from assessing the risk factors and trying to eliminate them, primarily in the majority of the patients, it's smoking cessation. Pulmonary rehab, I mentioned, and then early evaluation for oxygen therapy is a must. And then some of these patients, if they're so severe or they're so debilitated or they have, apical bolus disease where you can do surgery and help these patients, that certainly should be considered. The pharmacological interventions, you all are aware of them for smoking cessation. I won't belabor the point, but the drugs are listed there. As I mentioned, you want to assess these patients' comorbidities, always screen for underlying cardiovascular disease, evaluate for osteoporosis, respiratory infections, the psychiatric component this chronic disease carries, diabetes, and also these patients are also at risk for lung cancer. So you want to assess for these and treat them appropriately if they do arise. And it definitely can alter their morbidity and mortality. Vaccination is an important part of treatment in these patients, and I'm pretty certain that there will be a question, if I had to guess, on the pneumonia vaccination. All adults 65 or greater get the pneumonia shot, and your high-risk patients less than 65, our COPD patient is considered high-risk, so they get the shot. The PPSV23 is the one that is the older one, and the PCV13 is the newer one. You want to give them both. If they have not gotten the 23 and they're vaccine naive, then you want to give them the PCV13 first, and then you can give them the 23. If they've already gotten the 23, they can get the PCV13 afterwards. Studies have shown that PCV13 is more effective in preventing invasive pneumococcal disease than the 23. And the flu vaccine, obviously, we give them every year. So I'm going to switch gears to asthma. another obstructive lung disease. And the prevalence of asthma in the United States is shown there. And the redder you are, if you will, the higher the prevalence. You can see up in the northeast Michigan, Midwest area, that the prevalence is a little higher, and then all the way in the west. African Americans are at higher, have a higher prevalence, as well as females and children. It is an obstructive pulmonary disease. There is airway obstruction, and as I mentioned, there's a little bit more reversibility than your COPD patient. Again, you do have the hyperresponsiveness and the airway inflammation that goes with the other obstructive diseases. The major symptoms: cough, wheeze, dyspnea. They may be hypocapnic to some degree if they're really working to breathe. The triggers. This is a bit of a fun slide. You want to identify the triggers that these asthma patients have. You can think of them as inflammatory triggers and irritants and other, if you will. We all are aware of them. There's allergens, there's pollen, there's food allergies, tobacco smoke, paint fumes, pollutants, cold air, exercise. Those are the ones that you want to look for. Reflux and medications. Don't forget, medications can have side effects as well. Again, you have mucus, muscle wall hypertrophy. There's less mucus secretion, but still the airway is hyper-responsive and narrow. I'm not doing so good with these buttons. Okay. Just to differentiate the different inflammatory cells that are involved in COPD versus asthma, usually with the COPD, as I mentioned, is the neutrophils, the macrophages, and the CD8 lymphocytes. With your asthma patients, it's the eosinophil mast cells and the CD4 lymphocytes. If their asthma is severe, then you have neutrophils and macrophages involved. Again, this is just another depiction of the differentiation. The biggest thing, again, is the T lymphocyte, the inflammation, and the reversibility. The two phases of asthma that we are aware of is the early response, where the major issue is the bronchospasm, and then you have the delayed response, where the major issue is the inflammatory response. Typically, it's more severe than the early response. Some of the characteristics for your early response: usually it occurs rather quickly after exposure, within minutes. It can last several hours, but it's usually relatively short-lived. It responds nicely to bronchodilators and steroids. And then you have your late asthmatic response, where you have your trigger. Usually, this is what happens in the majority of patients. Usually it occurs later on, several hours after exposure, and it responds well to steroids or chromalin sodium. Don't forget the different asthma syndromes. You want to evaluate not only for triggers and allergy symptoms. There's the cough variant asthma. You have exercise-induced bronchospasm. You have occupational asthma, aspirin sensitivity-related asthma, reactive airway dysfunction syndrome, where there's exposure to high concentration of irritant and it's rather short-lived, virus-induced, and then allergic bronchopulmonary aspergillosis, where you have colonization of aspergillus resulting in mucus plugging, bronchiectasis, and reactive airway disease, and fleeting infiltrates is the key feature, the buzzword, I should say. Other contributing factors you want to keep in mind in your asthma patients is not reflux, definitely sinus disease, your patients that are overweight, your obese patients. Patients that have chronic aspirations can have chronic reactive airway disease. Your vocal cord dysfunction patients also have issues with reactive airway disease. In terms of asthma management, you can look at it in four components. You want to evaluate your objective measures in terms of your spirometry, your clinical features, et cetera. Patient education is a very important piece. You want them to be aware that trigger avoidance is a key component in their treatment, and they should know how to check their peak flow measures at home. Environmental control measures should be addressed, and then pharmacotherapy, the medications and secretion clearance, et cetera. This I definitely can't read, but again, the choice of management, the drugs are essentially the same as your COPD patient, and they would be the same for obstructive lung disease overall. Your short-acting bronchodilators, your long-acting bronchodilators, your inhaled corticosteroids or oral steroids. The leukotriene antagonists are the ones that you would use more for asthma versus your COPD patient. And then you have your immunomodulators that are used in severe cases where you've tried everything else and they're still having symptoms and they're still, you know, having issues. And the IgE level, if that's significantly elevated, then certainly they would fall into this category. It is an expensive drug, so it's not readily approved unless unless you've gone through everything else. We all know the mechanism of action for corticosteroids. It prevents the activation and directed migration of inflammatory cells. It interferes with arachidonic acid metabolism and the synthesis of leukotrienes and prostaglandins. So steroids are a very key component in your treatment of asthmatic patients. Primarily, the inhaled corticosteroids work pretty well. This you can read on your own. I'm running a little short on time, but again, these are the major adverse side effects of corticosteroids, which I did touch on in terms of hyperglycemia, weight gain, osteoporosis. Keep those in mind because you want to look for those and treat accordingly. The leukotriene antagonist, the primary mechanism of action is bronchodilation and anti-inflammatory action. It's less effective than your inhaled steroids, but it can potentiate your corticosteroid action. One of the things you want to remember with your side effects with leukotriene antagonists, elevated liver enzymes, you want to follow that. Headache and dyspepsia is common, and one of the rare side effects is eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis, which was formerly called Churg-Strauss, just to confuse us all. And then you have theophylline as an option. It's still an option. We don't use it as first line. But if you remember, it inhibits the action of phosphodiesterase, which prevents the breakdown of cyclic AMP. So then you have increased cyclic AMP levels in the tissue, and that results in smooth muscle relaxation. It improves airflow, mucociliary clearance, and it can moderate respiratory center stimulation. It's used in chronic asthma patients. You can manage reversible components of chronic bronchitis and emphysema. Again, it's not the first line agent. It can be combined with your other agents that we went through. Adverse effects are always asked for theophylline, tachycardia, arrhythmia, seizure. Keep that in mind. If someone has a history of seizure or they have a history of cardiac ectopy, you may not wanna go to this drug right from the get-go. Again, this I'm going to just use, I listed here just because a lot of times they ask you what drugs can theophylline can increase, theophylline clearance is increased by which of the, you know, which drug or decreased by which one. So there's a list that you can, you know, commit to memory. And just a word or two about the immunomodulators, omalizumab. It's a monoclonal antibody directed against human IgE. It prevents IgE binding with receptors on mast cells and basophils. It's not the first-line therapy. Like I said, it's expensive. It's a subcutaneous injection. It will decrease the release of allergic mediators. And the newer drug is the anti-IL-5, mepolizumab, which also is on the market. Again, this is just a chart. You could probably, it's another stepwise approach chart, and it's pretty similar to your COPD, except that with your asthma patient, you want to start your inhaled corticosteroid early. So if your patient has symptoms, frequently, you've tried the PRN bronchodilator. You've tried the long-acting bronchodilator, so you can add an inhaled corticosteroid versus a LAMA that you would with your COPD patient. Bronchial thermoplasty is an option in your asthma patients. It was FDA approved in 2010 as an adjunct therapy for use despite optimization of asthma treatment. So what they do is they bronchoscopically induce a catheter that applies thermal energy to conducting airways that are 3 millimeters or greater with the goal of reducing smooth muscle thickening. It's usually multiple sessions. The lung function generally remains unchanged, but there's a notable improvement in their symptoms. And one of the adverse effects is temporary bronchospasm with this procedure. So it is available. Again, just to reiterate, you want to also review some of the other topics that I didn't have time for in 30 minutes. You want to be familiar with alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, cystic fibrosis, and then the diseases that can cause bronchiectasis. And that's it.